From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. The former police officer charged with the murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis 2 weeks ago makes his first appearance in court today. And a majority of the city council now says they're in favor of dismantling the police department. Council President Lisa Bender said at a meeting held public outdoors yesterday that she envisions a new model for public safety.
Our commitment is to end our city's toxic relationship with the Minneapolis Police Department and to recreate systems of public safety that actually keep us safe.
NPR's Layla Fadel joins us now from Minneapolis. And Layla, what does dismantling the police department mean in practice, disbanding or abolishing it altogether?
Well, according to these city council members, that's exactly what it means. They read a statement that said they want to begin the, quote, process of ending the Minneapolis Police Department and creating a new transformative model for cultivating safety in Minneapolis. And they say they've come to this conclusion because decades of reforms haven't worked. And it's Black people who most often deal with excessive use of force by law enforcement. And organizers from Black Visions, which is the advocacy group that here that's really been the driving force behind the Defund Police campaign, see a police-free future with community solutions to community problems as the safest way forward, because they say police make communities like theirs less safe. And this is what Candace Montgomery, she heads Black Visions, told me at the Defund Police rally that came before this announcement.
But people are ready for transformation. People are done with weak reforms. And we want justice now. And this is what justice looks like to us.
Layla, does the city council have the final say? Has anyone laid out a plan or a timeline?
Well, at this point, there are few answers about what a police-free future actually looks like. Who responds to 911 calls? What do you do in the case of a break-in or a violent crime? But like you heard from Bender, there are hints about what these council members are thinking, that instead of people responding with force and weapons, there may be a new approach to public safety with a focus on mental health and public health services and investment in housing and education rather than weaponry for the police. But remember, this was just a pledge to do it, not a vote by the city council.
Yeah.
It's significant, of course, because 9 of the 13 city council members made the pledge, and that means they can override a veto from the mayor. But after the promise, council members caution that this promise is just the beginning, that they'll get community input, that they have to come up with a plan. So it sounds like it'll take quite a while.
Yeah. What are police unions saying about this idea?
Well, the Minneapolis Police Department has been quiet so far and given no statement, but police unions, like you mentioned, are saying that defunding or slashing budgets is actually the quickest way to make communities less safe. I spoke to one ex-police officer here in Minneapolis who really dismissed it as fantasy. She's African-American, lives in a largely African-American community, and she said it's a great idea in a perfect world, but it probably wouldn't work. What would you do if you respond to a domestic call with someone irate and abusive and possibly armed? Do you have a health provider, a social worker that's unarmed there? So she had a lot of questions about what this could actually look like.
Yeah, but we do know there are cities who have dismantled their police departments. Mm-hmm. For instance, Camden, New Jersey. But as you said, it is controversial. Minneapolis's mayor doesn't support it. Their Democrats actually unveiled legislation today in Washington supporting police reforms, but not this step of disbanding altogether. So really, how hard will it be? I mean, once we start to talk about a city council vote and stakeholders at the table?
You know, honestly, until less than 2 weeks ago, the amount of support this is now getting didn't seem possible. And it appears that, yes, it will be an uphill battle. Like you said, a lot of people don't understand how law would be enforced without police. There's a lot of concern about disbanding law enforcement. Will there be a security vacuum? Who fills that vacuum? But there's also a lot of hope that maybe something can be transformed, that law enforcement can be reimagined, because so many people feel like when police get involved in their communities, in Black communities, it actually makes it much less safe for them, that they're not protected.
Hmm. With the few minutes that we have, you know, this dismantling of police departments has also become a very political, a rallying cry for the right. How is that going to play out in this overall debate?
Well, the right has really tried to paint these protesters as dangerous and rioters and looters, and while yes, there were break-ins and fires in the first days of the protests, the majority of this protest movement has been peaceful and has really been trying to finally get something change on issues of systemic racism and police brutality, and now there seems to be movement on that.
That's NPR's national correspondent Layla Fadel reporting from Minneapolis. Layla, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Well, even as they're covering the protests, some newsrooms are wrestling with their own. Over the weekend, a top editor at the New York Times and another at the Philadelphia Inquirer resigned. The Times had published an op-ed calling for the military to move on protesters. The Inquirer had a headline about property damage from protesters that read, "Buildings matter too." And the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette benched black reporter Alexis Johnson after her tweet with photos of trash streets and her copy that read, "Horrifying scenes from selfish looters who don't care about this city." Oh, wait, sorry, no, these are pictures from a Kenny Chesney concert tailgate. Whoops. Editors said that revealed bias, and therefore she couldn't report on the protest objectively. NPR's media correspondent David Fogenblick is here. Hi, David.
Hey, Robin.
So start with the resignations. The New York Times editorial page editor James Bennett resigned after in-house outrage over that op-ed from Republican Senator Tom Cotton, which called for the deployment of troops to help police and protest. The Times first defended their move in publishing it. Now they aren't. Your thoughts on their conclusion?
Well, you know, initially, James Bennett and his now former boss, publisher A.G. Sulzberger, gave a fairly robust defense of publishing Cotton's op-ed. Cotton had basically said this: the deployment of military troops is needed, even overriding the concerns of governors and mayors to quell violent unrest. He's claimed to be focusing on looters, but, you know, they would be there interacting with protesters, and we've seen the violence that has ensued when police have already clashed. Imagine it being more militarized. Mm-hmm. A number of journalists within the newsroom said, look, this affects journalists, particularly journalists of color, who have been badly treated and sometimes rather savagely treated by some police officers at these things across the country. And ultimately, Bennett and Sulzberger backed down. They said they hadn't paid attention to some of the concerns. And James Bennett acknowledged he hadn't read this, what was clearly going to be an incendiary column headline, "Send in the troops," before it was posted. Now, there's a lot of content for Bennett to review every day, but this was one he needed to flag for himself and for his boss. Bennett had been seen as a possible leader for the newsroom, the news side, which is operated separately from the opinion side down the road after Dean Baquet retires. This sidelined him from that.
Well, of course, some people immediately said, wait, an op-ed page is for all opinions, but there, you have to go back to, really, you're not supposed to yell fire. You can't be incendiary. But we'll move on to the Philadelphia Inquirer. Their headline, "Buildings Matter Too," about destruction of property during protests, seemed to weigh buildings against black lives. Dozens of employees went on strike. Top editors resigned. The paper apologized. What are your questions here? I mean, do you have questions about whether editorial direction should come up from staff or come down from editors?
Well, from what one can tell, you know, this seemed to be an article that did come from the architecture critic, somebody who's written about urban development for the paper for some time. And it was a question of the headline, "Buildings Matter Too," seemingly equating, in the belief of a number of journalists at the Inquirer, property damage to loss of human life. It is perfectly legitimate to explore what the repercussions are for communities, even for communities of color, when there's violence, when there's vandalism, when there is looting. What does that do for economies? What does that do for communities? You know, at such a fraught moment, it probably is worthwhile that a company that traffics in communicating with the public think carefully about what exactly it's communicating.
Yeah. The Pittsburgh Post-Gazette barred Alexis Johnson. This is a black reporter. They said she couldn't cover protest after she published that tweet, which editors said proved bias. You spoke to her for your piece on Morning Edition. We'll link to that. But here's what she had to say about what they told her.
They kept doubling down, saying, "I gave my opinion through the tweet." And I don't think that's the case at all. I think people made their own opinions of what I was trying to say. I thought it was kind of clever.
David, what do you think?
I think here you have a reporter who is a native Pittsburgh resident who's father was a retired state trooper whose mother is a retired probation officer who's being accused of bias, not allowed to pitch stories or write about protests unfolding in her hometown. Meanwhile, I was able to talk to a white reporter who had tweeted a vulgar, essentially disparagement of a man accused of looting and linking to his own story. He was also warned about tweeting, but he was not prevented from doing further stories involving the protests. He was only barred from doing that a few days later when the union stepped in and said, hey, we think there's disparate treatment here of a black reporter and her social media commentary compared to that of a white reporter there. And the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette top editors that were involved in this and their bosses, for that matter, haven't come forward and explained their thinking. Today, you're hearing the union step forward and accuse the news leadership of essentially discrimination and bias on Alexis Johnson's behalf, and also of black photographer Michael Santiago, an award-winning photographer, also barred from such coverage because of his social media commentaries.
David, just have a half a minute here. What do you think we're hearing and finding out about newsrooms here?
I think you're seeing some real friction between long-enduring journalistic tenets, the idea of a pursuit of objectivity, with the idea from a lot of younger reporters and reporters of color in particular, who say, no, 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 we've got to be true to the facts. We've got to be true to fairness. The idea that we can always be impartial, that we have no stake in what's happening and no eyes to see what's truly happening, is a disservice to our readers and to journalism itself. And that's the tension there.
Mm. NPR's media correspondent David Folkenflik, thank you.
You bet.
New figures from Johns Hopkins University show rates of COVID-19 going up in 22 states, and researchers are pointing to all those Memorial Day gatherings a couple weeks ago. Makes sense. Remember when people in Alabama and Florida first began hitting the beaches and bars, going to church services as restrictions were lifted in those states? And we heard many say, well, if Donald Trump isn't wearing a mask, I don't have to. God has a plan for me, and when it's my time, it's my time. Or it's not as bad as the media says. Well, our next guest has some insight into at least those last two comments. He might have said them once, but not anymore. Not since 46-year-old Brian Hitchens, a devout Christian, survived a ferocious bout with COVID-19. His wife, Erin, was put on a ventilator over a month ago. She's still battling the disease. He now has a new message. Listen closely. He's still fighting a COVID cough and a bad phone line. Brian Hitchens is a rideshare driver in Jupiter, Florida. Brian, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
How is your wife, Erin?
It's still day to day. She was off of sedation, not completely off of sedation, but on a partial sedation. And she was able to respond to commands, answering questions, nodding yes, and then nodding for no. And then also when the nurse asked her to squeeze her hands, she was able to squeeze her hand. Mm-hmm. They've been playing around with the ventilator settings to see which is the best one, but her lungs are still not to where they need to be at, so they raised up the ventilator to 80%. So, you know, earlier on, I did mentally prepare myself for the possibility of her, you know, passing on, which is it's hard to do. This is the greatest illness for sure. But if anybody can bounce back after a serious illness like this, it's her.
Yeah. So take us back, Brian. You characterize what you thought about the coronavirus and all the, the alarm that was being raised.
When we were first hearing about it, we were hearing different things about it. There was other viruses out there and diseases like the H1N1 flu. There was the bird flu, and we didn't get hit by that. So, you know, we kind of thought, well, let's keep an eye on it. There's a verse that says, do not fear him that could kill the body only, but fear him that could destroy body and soul in the lake of fire. So I know that whatever could harm my body, that's all it could do. It does not have any authority of where my afterlife will be at.
But were you also, when you say the messages were mixed, where were you getting your information? Because President Trump was saying it would go away like a miracle. What was forming your opinion about how it wasn't a big deal? Because certainly there were millions of other Americans who were running to get face masks, and they thought it was a big deal. So what else was forming your opinion about how big a problem this was?
I think what it was they were having us, you know, social distance and closing down so many of the social places like bars and supermarkets. I always wondered if there was more going on that we weren't being told.
Was that because you didn't trust the science, or what was happening in your community? Or
it wasn't really not trusting or trusting in science. I would say mid to late January, I went to a revival service, and he was prophesying about the 5G and that there's going to be some sort of outbreak that it'll affect a lot of people health-wise. So I thought, I wonder if what we're seeing is linked to that at all.
It is a conspiracy theory. I have to say it's a completely false theory. Right. that somehow, right, 5G broadband, cell phone towers are causing this. You really are really giving us a insight into the confusion a lot of Americans might have felt.
I just thought maybe there was something more going on.
And then suddenly, you and your wife, Erin, get sick. How sick were you?
Physically exhausting. Like getting up to go to the kitchen, fixing yourself some meat, and coming back to bed, felt like you ran like a 10-mile marathon. And I felt really out of breath, and all I wanted to do was sleep. My wife, then, she started not to feel that great either. She had been not holding her food down, and, I mean, I've had some waves of nausea too, and I said, you know what, we're not chancing this thing. So we went back to the hospital, and we both came out positive.
As you wrote in one of your Facebook posts, or I think told somebody at the time, you know, you'd get up and pray and trust in God. Mm-hmm. There were masks and gloves, but you thought it looked a little hysterical. And you also, as you said, thought maybe the government was doing something. When did that shift?
Well, I'm in the hospital. She's in one room. I'm in the other. Still hearing people that say it's a fake disease, and I think there's still people going around that's saying it is. And there's a lot of end times prophecies about epidemics and things like that, things to look out for. You know, I would pray and trust and all that. That's great, but your faith is only representing one side of the coin. So I was only operating on one side of the coin. Mm-hmm. So I took things that we were hearing in the news and stuff. It's like, well, is this really that bad? You know, yeah, definitely. As we got further and further, you know, when I was in the hospital talking to nurses and hearing their experience, you know, really shed a new light. And it was kind of like a wake-up call. Mm. The hysteria that I thought was crazy at one time, people were just listening. Mm. Yeah, it is real, and warnings are there to protect us. So, like the CDC, yeah, or if they make mandates to wear a face mask when you go out in public, yeah, do so. It's for your own protection.
I hope this, yes, doesn't offend. I mean it in the most caring way, because it's reminding me of something, yeah, I heard, I'm pretty sure, in Sunday school. I've shared it here before. You know, man comes down with a terrible illness. Let's say it's cancer. And he refuses help, yeah, because he tells everyone, oh, no, God is going to save me. And oncologists came and he said, no, no. And the best surgeons came. He said, nope, God will save me. And sadly, he died. And he got to heaven and he said to God, why did you forsake me? And God said, what are you talking about? I sent you an oncologist. I sent you a surgeon. You know, and in your case, I sent you face masks. I sent you scientists. Yeah. I mean, is that what you're saying? It's a little bit like that?
Yes, exactly. Jesus, yes, only he healed so many people by miracles, and God still does that. But he also wants to use us to use the resources that's been provided.
couple things. We know that when you posted this, you know, people take this seriously. This is no kidding around. This is not a hoax. Just think about what I said. If you have to go out, use wisdom. Don't be foolish like I was. So this same thing won't happen to right. you. Is that the message you want to convey to people?
Yes. The warnings, they're not there to take away freedoms. I mean, I know that there are some people out there like, oh, they just want to take away your freedom. Look, you know, I understand how you feel, okay? But, you know, this COVID thing is nothing to fool around with. You know, we need to listen to the experts. We need to listen to scientists, listen to our government leaders. And there's a lot of people who are faith believers, and there's actually scriptures in the New Testament in Romans chapter 13 about not, you know, not disobeying government authorities. So if they come out and say, you know, wear a mask out in public, you know, if we don't do that, that's going against scripture. So when I looked at them, I'm like, why are we not doing what they want us to do?
It's yeah. in the scripture, Brian, yeah. but it's also saving your life.
Yes. Yeah. You know, God working through the CDC and the scientists.
But when you gave this tremendous life-saving advice out, we know some people were a little nasty to you. What did they say?
Well, after some people heard that I got sick, I would get the hate messages. Some people just looked at how I thought of it in my past, and they got so angry of why I would think a certain way. They just are unforgiving, and they just want to, you know, oh, you're sick, you ought to die, you know, I deserved it, you get what you deserve, and all that. And, you know, and I've had a lot of supporters too. So hey, don't worry about those haters out there, you know, I don't.
Well, Brian, we want to say thank you so much for your message here today. And you came by it the hard way, but thank you.
Right. Sometimes lessons are learned the hard way.
Yeah. Well, maybe you've been sent. So thank you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Yeah.
Take care. And please keep us posted on Aaron, okay?
Okay.
Bye-bye. Brian once doubted the seriousness of COVID-19. Not anymore. He survived it. His wife is on a ventilator. College graduates, class of 2020, you are graduating into what today became an official recession, according to the National Bureau of Economic Research, as if you didn't know that before. For more, let's bring in Jill Schlesinger, business analyst for CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
And we've been hearing the story. 70% of companies have canceled internships. 1 in 5 of those companies are considering rescinding offers they've already made to members of the class of 2020. This according to the National Association of Colleges and Employers. You know, tell us a little more about what grads are facing.
Well, I feel terrible. And again, this is just the bad luck of graduating into a recession. So we know from last Friday that the broad unemployment rate, and I'm going to use the broad rate because I think the headline number kind of misses a lot of people, but about right. 21% unemployment rate is what we're facing right now with about 20 million Americans sidelined. And, you know, if you think back, turn the clock back to, let's say, January or February, this was going to be a great job market for the class of 2020. We were at a 50-year low in the unemployment rate. And there were companies that were like going for bidding wars with these young students. And now that has tide has turned. So we know this is simply bad luck. It's going to be a long slog for these young graduates to get jobs.
And what can we learn? I mean, this is a unique time in American history. But what can we learn from what happened to the class of 2008 or 2009? They also graduated into recession.
Well, the New York Federal Reserve Bank actually did a good long study of the young graduates who came into the workforce in 2008 and 2009. And what was found was something quite interesting. first of all, it's clear that we saw many of these kids, I say kids, sorry, but you know, that's how they are to me. They suffered from underemployment, meaning that they took jobs that were basically not utilizing their degrees. So normally, let's say about a third of kids say are underemployed. That moved up to 46%. But what we also know is that those younger people who graduate into a recession tend to have a 10-year time horizon before they can basically get back to where they would have been compared to those who were graduating into a decent economy. And the losses in terms of wages, it's about 9% of annual earnings in the first 5 years, and then that goes to about half. But it takes 10 whole years to kind of get back on pace.
Yeah. Well, so what should grads do? Or high school grads, too, who might have been looking at college and now college is online. That comes with debt. Should people start taking one of those years where maybe you go off and volunteer? There's lots of need across the country, or just leap at the first offer that comes, even though it has nothing to do with what you plan? What should they do?
I think if you're lucky enough to get a paid position, you should take it. And you will learn something. Even if it's the most rotten job in the world, you'll be able to tell your friends, that was the most rotten job I had in the world, and you made money doing it. It doesn't really matter. I think for a lot of people, they are going to have to go that volunteer route because, again, you are now competing with millions of other Americans who are probably a little older, wiser, and might have more experience than you, and they will take any opening that they can find as well. So I think taking any job is great. You can't find a job. You go to a nonprofit. You raise your hand. You say, do you need me on a project? Is there something I can put on my resume? Here's the good news. Any future employer will understand that you're out of work during this period of time.
Right. And parents, you might have to have a discussion with your kids about maybe you're supporting those grads a little bit longer. Jill Schlesinger, business analyst for CBS News, host of Jill on Money. Thank you.
Great to be with you.
Protests against racism and police brutality have grown to at least three continents around the world after the death of George Floyd in Minnesota just 2 weeks ago. At a recent protest outside of the U.S. Embassy in Mexico City, a crowd observed 8 minutes and 46 seconds of silence for Floyd. They shouted Black Lives Matter in Spanish and then English.
Las vidas negras importan!
There have also been protests in Europe and Asia, and Korean boy band BTS is helping spread the message. You're listening to BTS on their single Black Swan from their latest album, and fans are taking their love to the next level. Just days after BTS donated $1 million to Black Lives Matter, a BTS fan group called One in an Army mobilized through social media to match that donation. And what's unique is that the fan group vetted 24 organizations that support the Black Lives Matter movement and then used a tech partner to give fans the option to split their donations to multiple efforts at once. Some of those groups include the ACLU, Unicorn Riot, and Color of Change. This fundraising effort is one example of how people are using social media and technology in real time during this social movement. Floyd's killing is also unprecedented in size, scope, and racial makeup. We wanted to see it for ourselves and learn more about what's driving non-Black people to the streets like never before. Myself and producer Christina Kim went to two protests over the weekend in Los Angeles County, one in the East LA neighborhood of Boyle Heights and Pasadena, California. It's where I spotted Tasha Kirksey, a Black woman originally from Chicago, recording a flood of protesters marching in the street past her apartment complex. She was holding her cell phone, recording her white, Latino, and Asian neighbors marching for Black lives.
It's just like so many people in solidarity, which I love, because it's like it's about time for us to get recognized and see that we're treated unfair. And so I'm glad that people are finally standing up for us because it's overdue. been overdue.
Pasadena is kind of a microcosm of the United States. About 10% of the people who live here identify as Black. And like most places in this country, there is a history of racism, like restrictive covenants that prevented Black and brown people from purchasing homes and attending schools here. The U.S. Supreme Court abolished them in 1948, but efforts to keep Black and brown residents out of Pasadena lingered for decades. At an intersection along Fair Oaks Avenue, that's a major road in Pasadena, Carolyn Bowling, along with her husband, 7-year-old son, and 4-year-old daughter, held up a Black Lives Matter sign written in Korean.
I was about 7 years old during the Rodney King riot. Some would say that my dad was one of the roof Koreans, you know, so he would go out and we wouldn't see him for days, you know.
During the 1992 riots, Bowling says her father joined a movement to protect their property by standing on the roofs of their storefronts with guns. 28 years later, Bowling is thinking deeply about her role in breaking down systemic racism.
It's really kind of embarrassing that, you know, we kind of look past this and we haven't done anything or spoke out about it. I'm trying to teach my kids, like, hey, you know, we live this privileged life. You don't understand, like, you know, the type of things that I've seen, you know, constantly. I've been seeing especially Blacks and Latinos and Asians get handcuffed before they're even questioned, you know. So, yeah, that's something that, you know, we're trying to teach our children. To be honest, I'm really quite embarrassed that I've gone this long without saying anything.
Walking alone was Minju Yoon, with a sign that read, Black Trans Lives Matter. She's been reading lately about police brutality against Black transgender people and wanted to be part of teaching what she's learned.
I think I've been in a learning process since the 2016 election. I used to be very moderate and liberal, and learning more about the history America has of oppression and systemic racism and how much it's been built on the genocide of Natives and just taking advantage of marginalized communities has really radicalized me.
A few steps away from Yoon was Ralph Teeday, a white man who, in the spur of the moment, decided that he and his wife should be here.
I'm a white man, and I was just sitting at home, comfortable, and we never did anything about the injustice. And I finally realized that it's my time to get involved.
What was it about this moment that made you decide, yes, I need to be a part of this action?
I think I see how angry people are and how many people are angry. And it's just hard not to join it and to get angry as well.
There's something else about T-Day's newfound activism. He's talking for the first time about racism with other white people in his life, like his in-laws.
We have a long conversation with her mom yesterday, and we noticed her changing the way she speaks about this issue, too, over the years, because we've been having these conversations for a while. And it's really great to see older generations kind of shifting the way they're thinking and talking about these issues.
I'm Christina Kim. About 10 miles south of Pasadena, in the East L.A. neighborhood of Boyle Heights, a historic Latino community that's in the midst of gentrification. Hundreds of protesters gathered at Mariachi Plaza, on foot and in cars, including Marcos Alvarez, who drove over 65 miles from Palmdale, California to be here. The neighborhood looks a lot different than when he was a kid, he says. We met at the intersection of 3rd and Indiana, right next to the corner where he used to get raspados, shaved ice. It's now a coffee shop.
Historically, the stereotype is that Blacks and Latinos don't get along, right? You have to tackle the problem from within. The leaders that be, whether it be Chirla, right, Immigration Rights of L.A., and other Chicano associations, to get together with Black Lives leaders, whether they be in Compton, whether it be in South Central, you got to reach out to East L.A. So the powers that be have to come together, shake that hand, create that dialogue, and get rid of the history that has divided us to begin with.
Alvarez recognizes that this kind of solidarity is painful, but also necessary.
I'm proud of my culture. I have witnessed many
wrong doings against the people of color, and I'm tired. Tired enough to reach out to my younger brothers and sisters in this community to make change.
This is the kind of change Deja Garcia has been thinking a lot about lately. She grew up in a household that didn't talk about race and racism openly. She's now having these conversations with her 2-year-old daughter.
You know, obviously she doesn't really understand it, but kind of trying to start a conversation at least with her. You know, our kids are the next generation, and we have to teach them in order to kind of move change. You know, we move it through the youth and the kids, and once you install it in them, who knows what the future will hold.
As the protesters weave through Boyle Heights, families and neighbors came out to watch, to hand out water. Leticia Garcia stepped out of her clothing store to cheer the protesters on.
Solo están levantando su mano y su voz.
People are just raising their fists and their voices. Our struggle, she says, is always about making things better for our future.
Para nada, porque queremos lo mejor para nuestro país, porque yo también me considero parte de aquí.
It's something Garcia believes in and wants for the United States, a country she now considers her own. Here in Boyle Heights, the message is clear. People came out to say Latinos support Black lives. And as so many of the signs read, Las vidas negras importan.
Boyle Heights and Pasadena, two very different communities that have joined a larger movement to demand justice and equality for Black Americans. A slice of the cross-racial solidarity we're bearing witness to all over the world.
There are still questions this week about last week's surprise Labor Department numbers showing unemployment down from 14.7% to a little over 13% against some economists' expectations that the unemployment rate would rise to 20%. Derek Thompson has been looking into what happened. He's senior editor at The Atlantic. He joins us from Washington, as he does every Monday. And Derek, the Labor Department disclosed in that report on Friday that there was an error in the data that would make the unemployment rate actually 3 points higher than was reported. So talk about this error.
Sure. So first, overall, I mean, this was arguably the most shocking jobs report in modern history. You had economists that were predicting that it would be the worst jobs report ever, that we would lose 7 million jobs. Instead, it found that we added 2.5 million, which means it was, technically speaking, the best job month ever. Now, it's hard to say that it's literally the best because unemployment is still so elevated, but it just goes to show how strange the economy is right now and how vast these swings of employment are. So as you said, there was a pretty severe misclassification error in the report. Here's what happened. Every month, the Bureau of Labor Statistics asks people about their work status. They say, are you working full-time? Are you working part-time, furloughed, unemployed, etc.? And the BLS made a mistake. They accidentally said that some people who were temporarily unemployed, so maybe furloughed, were actually just absent from work for other reasons, like maybe, for example, they were sick.
Or this absent from work for other reasons. This is, you know, people who are on jury duty. As opposed to all those furloughed workers, they got put in that category?
That's right. Furloughed workers were essentially treated as if they were on jury duty. And look, that is a mistake. And the BLS said, oops, we made this mistake, and this is what the numbers would look like if we hadn't made this mistake. And if you correct for the error, first you see that actual unemployment is actually higher than what was reported. And second, you find that unemployment is actually declining even faster than reported. On Friday. But the most important thing to note is that this is not some conspiracy on the part of the federal government. This was a mistake, and a mistake that they were relatively transparent about.
Yes, even Jason Furman, a former top economist for President Obama, tweeted out, you can 100% discount the possibility that President Trump got to the BLS, Bureau of Labor Statistics. 100%, this is a misclassification error. But continue to explain, because Friday's report said that unemployment was a little over 13%. Economists are now saying that with this data correction, it's actually a little over 16%, much higher. But you have to correct the month before as well. So explain.
If you correct for the misclassification error, then the unemployment rate in April was about 20%. and the unemployment rate in May was about 16%. So that's a decline of, you know, 3-4 percentage points. That's more than the technical decline that they reported with the misclassification error. The big picture is this was a mistake. Actual unemployment is higher than the official report, but it's actually coming down even faster. Yeah.
So that unemployment rate, while it's probably higher, it's falling at a steeper drop, which is what we want to see. But could that drop be a dead cat bounce, worst economic phrase ever, but a great Irish band? But it pretty much means something that won't count, like it'll bounce right back down. In other words, it's not real. What are you hearing? Are economists concerned?
This is the best way that I would think about it. We lost 20 million jobs in April. We added back 2.5 million jobs in May. That means we essentially recovered about 1/8 of April's job losses in May. That's a fantastic recovery for just 1 month, but it's not nearly enough. 7/8 of those job losses are still out there. So we still need to wait for the June, July, August reports to find out if we're going to continue recovering 2.5, 3 million jobs every single month, because that's really what we're going to need. We're essentially going to need the fastest recovery of jobs in American history to avoid this essentially becoming another Great Depression.
And another question that is maybe too hard to answer now is, of those jobs that read as recovered, that could just be money from the PPP, the payroll protection, which some critics say it's just transferring people from government unemployment to another form of government unemployment, which was the money the government gave out for employers to pay workers. But it made the unemployment look better, even though it's still government money.
Yeah, the thinking behind PPP, the philosophy, wasn't so much to disguise the unemployment numbers and make them seem lower than they actually were. It was thinking, all right, if we lose 20, 30, 40 million jobs in a matter of months, hiring back all those people is going to be a nightmare. What you want to do is preserve the relationship between workers and their employers as much as possible. That's what PPP does. It essentially pays workers to stick with their companies, even if they're not actually doing work for a few weeks.
And gets them off the unemployment rolls. It just happens to be a side effect. Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. Thanks as always.
Thank you.
Okay, my head broke. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.